This is August 21st. Dave Noyes and Hillman here preparing some questions for the president. The first deals with this question of the framing of the Constitution, with a debate over whether a president should be re-elected. For the following reasons, says this outline, the authors of the Constitution dismiss the idea that a president should not be re-elected. First, if he served once and might not serve again, he would be dangerous because there would be no inducement for him to conduct himself so as to retain the favor of the people. Second, it would deter him from beginning long-range projects for the public benefit. Third, an ambitious man might try to prolong his term by force. Fourth, the country would lose the experience of the president. Fifth, such a ruling might turn a president out of office in a moment of national emergency. Sixth, by making it necessary to elect a new president, the ruling would require by law that there be a lack of uniformity in policy whether or not the policy was desirable.
Why don't you just comment as you go along in light of this outline? And
I think this outline is... I think this outline is correct. There is no question in the world but what the executive ought to be as independent as possible of the legislative branch of the government and also of the courts, the Supreme Court in particular, in his carrying out of a policy. And I think that the statement that has just been made is a correct one.
Well, how do you feel about a single term, let's say, for a president?
I don't agree with it at all, because I think that the president should be elected at specified periods. I also have some idea about how the Congress ought to be elected, too. I think when the president is elected for a four-year term, the House of Representatives ought to be elected with him for a four-year term, and I've about come to the conclusion that it'd be a good thing to elect half the senators at that time for an eight-year period, and then elect another half of them in another 4 years for another 8 years. I think probably that would make it much more available, make the Congress much more available to the way the people feel, and it would also give the president a chance to have a lower house of the Congress, which controls the purse strings, along with him when he's elected.
That's interesting, that comment about the Senate. Instead of now the one-third every 2 years, you would...
Well, what I was thinking about was getting rid of this general election every 2 years on a national basis. I don't think it's at all necessary. And especially it is not necessary with regard to the members of the House of Representatives, because if they were elected for a four-year term, they could serve 2 years without thinking about being re-elected. Now, whenever a congressman is elected, he begins to run for re-election 2 years hence. And he doesn't have a chance to give the time that's necessary for him to be a proper legislative servant of the people.
Therefore, you think that that the people should be entitled to their representatives having more leisure to time to do work and to think rather than to rush in every 2 years.
Oh yes, I don't think they have a chance in the House of Representatives to do anything but to think about being reelected. Only in those districts which are permanently tied up by a situation that has developed after the Civil War. I think it'd be much better if the congressman could be elected along with the president at the same time for a four-year period, and they'd be in a position to do a much better legislative job than they are now. I may be off the beam on that, but I think I'm right. And the reason I thought about the Senate situation, the way the Senate is now, is divided into three sections, which are elected every 2 years. If it were divided into two sections, one elected every 4 years, and the senators were elected for 8 years, they'd have a much better chance to represent the states than they do now.
Well, aren't
especially since the senators are elected by popular vote.
Well, aren't you creating another problem by removing the problem of preoccupation with political matters by the members of the House, since they're to be elected every 2 years? Aren't you getting the Congress too far away from the people, because then the people don't have any way of expressing themselves in case the Congress or the administration or both stray from the people on policy?
No, I don't think there's any foundation for an argument like that, for the simple reason that they have no recourse with the executive except every 4 years. And if the executive has a lower house of the Congress who is elected at the same time he is, then that doesn't necessarily mean that he'd have a majority. They will have the same, the people will have the same recourse that they have now with the president. That's close enough, in my opinion.
Well, how do you correct him in case he goes off on a tangent?
You can't. We've had that amply demonstrated time and again in the history of the presidency.
Well, these times are a little bit more rapid in their reaction, and we have now world involvement. How do you put a check on the president?
That's what everybody seems to think, and I don't think it's necessary to put a check on the president. When you elect a president, you ought to elect a man who knows where he's going and knows how to get there. And if you don't do that, you get what's coming to you.
At any rate, you have had a Congress which has been democratic, and they certainly have had a check so far as the people are concerned, but that hasn't made any difference so far as the president's concerned.
Not a particle. The president is the key to the administration of the government of the United States, and there would be no particular change in the setup if this change in the election setup was made, because it would just make it much less expensive on the people for elections, and would give the congressman the same chance to deliberate and think about what is going on as the senators now have.
Well then, Mr. President, in your stressing the division of the government into three departments, you certainly stress the fact that the executive department, that is the president, is the most important part of the government.
Yes, the president is the most powerful man in the government. The Speaker of the House is the next most powerful man because he controls the appropriations. And the Chief Justice is the next most powerful man in the government because the courts finally, in the long run, pass on the laws which have been enacted by the Congress.
Well, I would like to get back to the tenure of the presidency itself, and how you feel broadly in terms, A, of your understanding of our history up to your own administration, and the tenure of the president in terms of your administration, because a certain amendment was passed during your administration, touching upon that.
That's true, but that amendment didn't apply to me. I could be elected to the presidency as often as I wanted to, even to succeed myself as often as I felt like it, but I didn't want to go back because I thought it was about time for the country to awaken to the fact that the people are responsible for the government they get. And when they elect a man to the presidency who does not take care of the job, they've got nobody to blame but themselves. And in 4 years, they have a chance to change it. They didn't do it this time.
Well, now, 4 years is either a long time or a short time, depending upon whom you've got as president.
It's a very short time in government.
Now,
it's a very short time in government.
Do you recall of any president who had overstayed his usefulness in office, even
no.
a four-year period?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't. It was necessary for Roosevelt to continue on account of the World War situation that was going on. And people themselves have to make up their minds when the time comes to elect a president. I think the worst amendment since the Prohibition Amendment is the 22nd Amendment, which limits the president to 2 terms.
Now, do you think that a president has any special powers that accrue to him in his second term that he doesn't experience in his first term?
No, I do not. It's the continuation of his program that's necessary if he has a second term. And in most cases, it isn't possible to get measures through the Congress in 2 separate terms of 2 years each or in 4 years. And therefore, if the president has a policy that is agreeable to the people, he ought to have a chance to carry it out. And in order to do that, he'd have to succeed himself.
Now, was the first 4 years a compromise, the four-year term, I mean, is that a compromise? How was that arrived at?
Well, the men who made up the Constitution Convention discussed the thing back and forth in every phase of its of their considerations. And they finally decided to make the executive independent of both the courts and the legislative branch of the government because of their experience with the Continental Congress, which never could act because they didn't have an executive to make them act.
But there was no preconception of how the office of chief executive would evolve. They left that more or less to the experience of time in that office.
Yes, but they set out four most important jobs for the chief executive, and they are still the most important jobs that he has. The others, as leader of his party and as a social leader of the state, are incidental to the points that are set out in the Constitution of the United States, which make the president a part not only of the legislative branch of the government, but also a part of the enforcement of the law which the legislative branch passes. And if you read that constitutional provision for the president that sets up the presidency very carefully, you find that the men who wrote the Constitution knew what they were doing.
Now, in light of that, why would they limit a president to two terms?
Well, I don't know why. I'll tell you why this two-term amendment was passed. It was passed by a vicious Republican Congress, the 80th Congress, and ratified by the states while people were still thinking about the wars which they had been through, and they wanted to get discredit the president who had served and been elected for four terms.
I'm sorry, I meant to refer to the custom that grew up, that the president be limited to two terms.
Washington established that custom, and he did it because he'd been so severely and attacked by the press of his time. He just decided in the first term that he wasn't going to run again, but Jefferson and Madison and Hamilton persuaded him to go ahead and run for a second term. After he'd been through his second term, he made up his mind that he just wouldn't take it anymore, and he quit. And that established a president. But the next president, John Adams, could not have been elected for the second term. Jefferson was elected for two terms. Madison was elected for two terms. Monroe was elected for two terms. And then John Quincy Adams came along and could not be elected for two terms. Andrew Jackson was elected for two terms. And a president has to carry out an administration that is for the welfare and benefit of the country as a whole, not only in his home affairs, but in its international affairs. And when he doesn't do that, he can't be reelected. So why worry about it?
Well, but the question continues to be raised by each party as to whether, in light of the later experience with the presidency, that the 4 years or 8 years is particularly a happy solution to the problem.
I think it is. I think it is, because if the president has done the job as he should, he has no trouble being elected for a second term. And if he feels like working his head off for another term, he's got a right to run for it.
Well, could I hold up here on for the first tape on the question of the re-election of the president and put in another tape?
Well,
this is August the 22nd. Mr. President, I'd like to start over and just say... I want to get to the point of, by making it necessary to elect a new president, the ruling would require by law that there would be a lack of uniformity in policy, whether or not the policy was desirable. Incidentally, this is take two in answer on the question of the re-election of the president.
Well, in reply to that, whenever a president inaugurates a policy that's worthwhile, it will carry through. For the simple reason, since we have now inaugurated the system of two-party government, that there are people in both parties who are interested on both sides of every question. And whenever a president inaugurates a policy which is for the welfare and benefit of the country, and his successor comes along, there isn't any idea that successor will completely upset that program. We've had that illustrated very well in the two terms which you've just gone through.
Well, I have several questions here. The first one that occurs to me is in connection with the statement that you made that no president upsets the policy or had upset the policy of his predecessor. Harding, to a very large degree, did reverse the policy of Woodrow Wilson when he came in.
And that's the best example I know as to what happens to the country when the policy of a great president is right and an attempt is made to upset that policy. It finally winds up so that policy in the long run has to be pursued. The policy of the people who followed Woodrow Wilson was to decide that everything he'd done was wrong. Well, they went along for about 12 years, and it turned out that the situation developed so that in the long run, when Franklin Roosevelt came along, the Wilson policy had to be implemented, and that's the best answer I know to give to it.
Well, now, was that for reasons of political advantage, or was that a basic difference in approach as between the two parties?
It was an effort to have political advantage. And temporarily, they got the political advantage, but it was ruinous to the country and caused the Second World War.
Now, we were at that time coming out of isolationism into an entirely new period of international relations, were
That's
we not?
Right. And we had 12 irreconcilables in the Senate that caused this situation, and they are to blame for all the youngsters who were killed in the Second World War. And I shall continue to say that as long as I live.
Well, that was a reversion to isolationism of the Harding. He not only got in on the political advantage, but it was a reversion to isolation. I mean, the people felt that way, otherwise he wouldn't have been elected.
Well, I don't think the people elected him because they thought he was returning to isolationism. I think they elected Harding because he told them that he would return to a normal condition. He coined the word normalcy and said that he was going to return to a normal condition. And I don't think the people themselves had any idea as a whole of returning to isolationism. But the irreconcilables and Harding, when he made his half-hearted statement that he would support the League of Nations, caused a situation which finally developed into a program that finally wound up with a wild speculative period which wound up in the Depression. And then we had a president who understood the situation to come along and reorganize the situation and let the people understand that they were a world power and they had to act like a world power. And then we got the United Nations as a result, which is exactly what the League of Nations was intended to be in the first place.
But that brings up a question about how a presidential candidate comes to the fore, and it's been plaguing us before that period and since, but the period about during the Harding coming into position, both parties had absolutely no outstanding candidate. Both parties were searching and searching for a leader, and neither party had one.
Yes, that was one of the difficulties, although Governor Cox of Ohio was a great man, and his vice president turned out to be one of the great presidents of the United States. And it finally came to the top after a while that there was leadership at that period, although it did not appear because the people wanted to change. They wanted to go back to things as they were, as they always do after an emergency, and they thought that they were going to get back there without any effort on their own part. But it finally cost them a Second World War.
But that it keeps on raising the point about how the people come in contact with leadership, or how leadership is brought out of the people. You had reference to FDR coming out of that
situation. That's right. He was the vice president, presidential nominee with Cox. And you know what, how that turned out in the long run. He became the President of the United States and one of the great ones.
Well, we've just been through another period involving your own administration, getting back to the business of continuity of policy in the important, all-important international field. When you were succeeded by Dwight Eisenhower, an attempt was made, and a very serious attempt was made, to reverse some of the basic policies established during your administration.
That's true, but they didn't succeed in doing it. And nobody had any reason to believe that Dwight Eisenhower, who had been through the whole program with President Roosevelt and General Marshall and myself, would attempt to do what he did attempt to do. He didn't succeed. He had to finally approve the policy which was established by Roosevelt and myself as far as the foreign policy of the United States was concerned, although we lost all our friends in the situation which developed when Dulles became Secretary of State and Eisenhower didn't work at the job. That's the only difficulty with the whole thing. The President did not follow through as President of the United States in carrying out the policy that was for the welfare and benefit of the country. He passed the buck down, which can't be done, and tried to let somebody else do the job which he ought to have been doing himself. In the long run, though, he had to make decisions.
Mr. President, aren't you saying, in effect, that our form of government allows the people not only great latitude in their choice, but gives them latitude in making grave mistakes? In other words, our form of government is no guarantee of wisdom of the people.
That's true. The people in the long run, though, usually make the right decision if they have somebody to give them the information that's necessary for them to have in order to make that decision. They'll make the right decision in the long run if they have the information on which to make it. But it's the policy of the present setup of the press to keep the people from knowing exactly what the facts are. And, of course, they were doing that to support the administration, which they thought was going to reverse things back to the time of Harding. It didn't succeed, thank goodness.
Well, how does a president really get to know what the people are thinking about and what it is that the people want?
Well, in the first place, he's got to have the necessary contacts all over the country with people that are trustworthy, people that will tell him the truth. And he also has to keep informed as to what is going on. And in addition to that, he must know the historical background that has carried on the government up to now from the time it was inaugurated in 1789. And that takes a lot of work. And he's got to find out what the press is saying and do his own analysis on it, because 9 times in 10, they don't tell the truth.
So he has to go beyond the reflections in the press, beyond the reflections of some of the people he sees regularly, because they are not a particularly fundamental or trustworthy source of information.
Well, they are trustworthy so far as they know. In most instances, with experience I've had, the people who wanted to furnish information to the president tried to do it honestly. But the president has to take all the information he can get from every source that he can possibly get it, then weigh it and make up his own mind on the subject as to what's right and what's wrong.
Now, in terms of the person of the president, he's presumed to need to have the common touch. What is the common touch? FDR had it, you had it. How would you describe it?
Well, I don't know how you would describe what you name the common touch. I think what you're aiming at is a man who understands people and the people's idea of what things should be done and should not be done. Most of the people have a moral background that is based on our former government and on the way in which we live, that the proper thing to do is to treat the people so that the majority of them have a right representation with the government and are treated on a right basis. Now, there's no way in the world for a man to cultivate that. He's got to know it to begin with. And he has to be through the experiences that the ordinary person has to go through with in order to raise a family, own a little property, and to be a citizen of a republic. That's the whole thing that's back of it. And I don't know how you're going to instruct people to do that. It just has to come naturally to them. And it has to come to those people who are willing to work to find out what it means.
In other words, as I get to the substance of this very interesting definition, it is inside, it's the inner man of the president himself who knows or senses what the people want and what the people don't want, what is right for them and what is wrong for them. The others he uses more or less to confirm and check, but it starts with the person of the president. The
president himself has got to be able to make up his mind after he gets all the information he can get as to what is best for the most people in a republic. And if he does that, he never has any trouble.
Of course, what you're stating, and I think what Dave is getting at, is that it is the character of the man that counts a good deal in this. He's got to do all these other things to read
also
and to
the conditioning
get information.
Of the man.
Well, he's got to be able to make up his mind and stick to it. When he finally comes to the conclusion that a certain program is correct, he must go through with that program and not allow himself to be swayed by all the pressures that are put on him if he still thinks the program is correct. If he can get information to show the program is not correct, he's got to have the ability to change his mind and start over. And that's the only way in the world that a man can carry on as a chief executive of this great nation.
But the common touch we're talking about, the common touch is something that which comes instinctively from the character of the man rather than any education he may have.
Well, it takes both. He's not only got to have the ability to make up his mind and decide what's right according to the lights by which he's been raised and educated, but he also has to be willing to listen and find out what effect the decision that he's about to make will have on the people. And when he makes up his mind that that decision is correct, he ought not to be swayed from making that decision under any consideration. If the decision's wrong, all he has to do is to get some more information and make another one.
Well, then, if you start and end with the man who is president, then the conditioning of that man has a lot to do with the thing. And how does that express itself when it gets to a military hero coming into the White House? Now, not in terms of just the immediate situation, but all the way back, if you can.
Well, we've had difficulty with our military heroes all the way down the line. The only military hero who really made a president was George Washington. And he had a background that was entirely different from most military heroes. He was not really a professional soldier. Old Zachariah Taylor didn't know what it was all about. Neither did William Henry Harrison, although he didn't stay there long enough to do any harm. Then the next person who came along as a military hero was General Grant, who had one of the worst administrations this country's ever seen. And the same thing was true of the present occupant of the White House. He didn't know the history of the country. He didn't know what the background was. He was educated as a military man with a military education, and that's what the trouble was.
All right, President, that's the end of this take two.